and Plot on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A new book written by a sitting member of Parliament sheds much needed light on the state of parliamentary democracy in Canada. It's written by someone who knows of what he speaks, someone on the inside, if you will. Brent Rathgeber is the independent member of Parliament for the riding of Edmonton-St. Albert. He was first elected to the House of Commons as a Conservative MP in 2008 and re-elected in 2011. In June 2013, however, he resigned from the Conservative caucus to sit as an independent due to the government's lack of support for transparency and accountability. He joins me now to talk about his book that looks at the failure of elected parliamentarians like himself, who have allowed prime ministers and their governments to run roughshod over the House and essentially subvert accountability. It's a compelling book with an examination of what's happened as well as what's happened to him, which gives us insight into what life is like on the Hill and what Canada is like with the Conservative Party and Stephen Harper in power. The website for more is at brentrathgeber.ca. The book is published by Dundurn, a part of their Point of View series, and the foreword is by Andrew Coyne. In Edmonton this morning, please welcome to the Plot on the Line program, Brent Rathgeber. Mr. Rathgeber, good morning.
Thanks for your interest, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. So take us back to June 2013, and that day that you announced you were going to resign. What had been happening with regards to the government, to your own legislative agenda that compelled you to step away from the Conservative caucus?
Well, I had a private member's bill. I think it was the C-461. It was the CBC and Public Sector Transparency and Accountability Act. And it sought out to do a number of things, but the most controversial, I suppose, from the government's perspective, was that it would allow the salaries of senior civil servants, both in Crown corporations like the CBC, but also in departments and in the Prime Minister's office, to have their salaries disclosed pursuant to Canada's access to information laws. And initially, the government had indicated that they were going to support this bill. There was some quibbling about what the exact bar would be. A number of provinces have enacted sunshine legislation where salaries above $100,000 is disclosable.
Mm-hmm.
This was a more modest attempt because it wasn't going to have a website of names and salaries, but it was going to allow individuals and media outlets to apply under access to information to get the specific salaries of senior managers and senior civil servants. The government, I said, was initially going to support it, but then decided somewhat late in the game when the bill was before committee that they weren't prepared to support it because they were concerned that it would lead to a number of bad news stories in the media when it was disclosed just how much and how many mid and high-level senior servants and Crown Corporation employees were earning above $200,000.
So was this one moment? Was this what really the tipping point, if you will, that set you off on this course to get out?
That was very much the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. There were a number of things that had led up to that. Ever since the 2011 election, I had used my blog and other social media to promote accountability and respect for taxpayers on such things as the F-35 procurement, which had gone sideways, the $16 orange juice that was famously consumed by then Minister Bevoda. A theme that I constantly harped about was the limousines on Parliament Hill that chauffeur the cabinet ministers from the nearby precincts to Centre Block and then sit there for 2 or 3 hours while we all vote and then shuffle the ministers back. So there were a number of accountability and transparency issues that I was critical of the government. And the staffers within the Prime Minister's office were not particularly thrilled about my blogging or my commentary. They very much viewed the backbench as being part of government, and therefore your role was to support and cheerlead for the government as opposed to what I saw my role, and that was to represent constituents and the taxpaying constituents of Edmonton St. Albert. So if I saw waste or if I saw abuse of taxpayers, I felt an obligation to bring it to the attention, sometimes in the House and sometimes through social media. And so that was the beginning of sort of my exit from the caucus. And at the very same time in the spring of 2013, you will recall, The Duffy Wright scandal had mm-hmm. broke, and there were all sorts of allegations about misappropriation of expense accounts and ineligible housing expenses. And what really got my attention and my concern was when the executive, in the form of the chief of staff, gave money to a sitting legislator, mm-hmm. that being Senator Duffy, and tried to make the scandal go away. I just thought that that was a very inappropriate lack of separation between the executive and legislative branches of government. And so all of these things were sort of boiling, and then when they decided to gut my bill at the committee, that was sort of the last straw for me, and I resigned from caucus the next day.
So I'm sure after you resigned, you heard from colleagues and friends, MPs, fellow MPs. Did you hear from any privately that say agreed with your position?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I heard from many members of the opposition, some who I think genuinely felt for my plight, and although some of them I think were just happy to see a government member quit. I think mm-hmm. From a partisan perspective, I think that made the opposition feel good. But I also did hear privately, very privately, from a number of my former colleagues in the Conservative caucus who were experiencing some of the same frustrations, maybe not to the same extent that I was, but certainly were experiencing some of those frustrations, and admired my courage for resigning from caucus over on a position of principle, because as you see even in the news this week, it's more often than not that members leave caucus because they're embroiled in some sort of scandal, mm-hmm. as opposed to leaving voluntarily over a principal position.
What struck me in reading your book was, and I don't know why this surprised me, because politicians are politicians, I guess, but you see a lot of members of parliament more concerned about their careers currying favor with the leadership rather than, say, representing their constituents. How insidious is that in your experience in these last two parliaments that you've sat in?
Well, I think that's actually the momentum that drives the career of backbenchers. Backbenchers want to become midbenchers. Midbenchers want to become frontbenchers. And that's really the glue that holds party discipline together. In my view, we have grossly oversized cabinets. We have a cabinet of 39 ministers plus the prime minister. There are another, I think, 21 parliamentary secretaries and a dozen committee chairs. So if you want to advance your career, that requires a certain amount of political capital to be built up within the Prime Minister's office, who, as everybody knows, appoints not only the ministers but the parliamentary secretaries. And technically, the committee chairs are appointed by the committees on recommendation of the whips, but that's all backdoor support done by, through the Prime Minister's office. So if you're want to have any of these positions, which come with extra staff and, of course, extra salary, you're well advised to do the party's bidding, support the government unequivocally, cheerlead and clap on demand, and, of course, vote as instructed by the whip. And, given that there's about 160 members in the Conservative caucus, close to half of them are either a minister, a parliamentary secretary, or a committee chair. So your chances are almost 1 in 2. I think they're about 1 in 2.5 that your career is going to be promoted at some point if you keep your head down and your nose clean. I, of course, went on a different route where I was challenging the government to respect taxpayers, and that put me on a collision course with the staffers in the Prime Minister's office that ultimately led to my decision to resign from the caucus.
So you weren't aspirational at all to become a minister in the government or anything like that?
I think maybe I was initially. I think I think honestly I was, and I discovered and was resigned to the fact that was unlikely to ever happen. I know you read my book, and readers will understand my understanding is that ministers are generally promoted for reasons that have very little to do with merit. Either they represent a region that is underrepresented, or they represent an ethnic group that requires representation in government. And as a result, I argue in my book that cabinets have become representative bodies, not deliberative bodies. that all the important decisions are made in the Prime Minister's office, and ministers, and there are some exceptions, and there are some strong ministers, but generally speaking, ministers are chosen for political reasons, i.e., to promote somebody from a region or a province where there is no representation, or to promote somebody who represents an ethnic group that the government is trying to curry favor to in hope to get more votes from that ethnic community. So I was resigned to the fact that promotion of my career being a unilingual Anglophone from Alberta, my chances of promotion were not good. So I decided very early in my career that I would adopt what was the more traditional role of the Member of Parliament, and that is to represent one's constituents, even if from time to time that would lead to a collision course with the government. And my constituents respected that. They still respect that. The government, the party, didn't respect that, and it ended in June of 2013 with my resignation.
So as a member of parliament, you are an independent, so you don't sit with any, you don't caucus with anyone, with any party. Do you find that your constituents are getting good value for their money? I mean, without, say, the government and its party behind you, I'm assuming that, say, funding to your constituency is probably a lot less than when you were sitting in caucus.
I actually don't think that there's an appreciable difference between the amount of government programs and government infrastructure money that's come into this riding. There is, in fact, less, but I think you would find that is constant everywhere as the government moves towards balancing its budget in this fiscal year, and as after the 2008 recession, the government made major investments in infrastructure to try to kickstart the depressed economy, and of course this constituency received generous funds in those days. Less so now, but that's not uncommon to any other constituency. But from the representative viewpoint, I think I argue, and I guess I'll test this theory in the 2015 election, that my constituents actually receive better representation, whereas where a member of any caucus will vote as the whip in that party wants him or her to vote, I'm able to assess pieces of legislation individually, consult with constituents when appropriate, and then cast a ballot based on my best judgment as to how a particular piece of legislation might affect my constituents. A very good case in point is the temporary foreign worker file, mm-hmm. which has been in the news quite a lot lately. And Alberta, as I'm sure you know, has a very unique labor situation where employers just can't find sufficient numbers of employees in all ranges, but especially highly trained construction workers to work at oil sands recovery projects and pipelines, and also at the lower end of the labor scale, fast food workers and individuals who clean hotel and motels. So we have acute labor shortages in this province, but for good reason, in other parts of the country, the temporary foreign worker program is not popular. There are parts of Canada where there is unemployment, significant unemployment, and significant youth unemployment. So the government has made a decision, I think a political decision, that they're going to cut. Back in June, they announced that there were severe restrictions on the number of temporary foreign workers that could enter Canada. That is hurting the Alberta economy. But the Conservative members of Parliament, which is all but two of us, myself and Linda Duncan from the NDP, the Conservative members of Parliament are all supporting this. They're all defending the decision, as opposed to advocating on behalf of Albertans, which I'm able to do, and I'm able to constantly ask questions during question period as to the effects of this program, and as the government considered the costs and what it could mean if the Alberta economy slows down. So, I mean, I'm actually think that I'm in a better position to represent constituents on policy questions, and the issue with respect to funding that's coming into this region. I actually don't think there's an appreciable difference. In fact, mm-hmm. maybe quite the opposite. I mean, I think the government wants to get this seat back.
I see.
So they've actually been paying attention to this riding, but making sure that they and not I get credit for it.
So I mean, how is this going to work out in next year when you seek re-election? I mean, you won't have the party apparatus behind you. How are you going to pay for signs and the sort?
Well, that's a challenge. Under our under our unfair electoral financing rules, independent candidates cannot raise money prior to the election being called. However, once the election is called, we do have the same ability to raise money and issue tax credit receipts, 75% on the first $100, the same as parties do. So I'll definitely, I mean, not only is the field unlevel, when I left the Conservative Party in the spring of 2013, the local riding association had a pretty healthy bank balance. So they'll be using money that I, for the most part, raised to try to unseat me. So politics is not a fair world, and anybody who tells you otherwise is, I think, dreaming. So I will be disadvantaged financially going into the 2015 election. There's no doubt about that. That being said, although money is very important in electoral politics, there are other factors. We have no shortage of volunteers who are lining up to assist in our efforts, and I think we have a good message, and that is that we want a representative, you know, not unlike the old Reform Party, that we want somebody to represent our constituents to Ottawa, not represent Ottawa to our constituents. So messaging and volunteers will help alleviate the lack of finances, and we'll have to see which way it goes. It's going to be a close and interesting election here in St. Albert, Edmonton. There's no doubt about that.
So, I mean, you know, you mentioned the Reform Party, and that's where this government's roots are. They certainly have strayed from that. I mean, do you hear from people in your riding, in your province, and perhaps across the country that are disappointed with the way Stephen Harper and his government turned out?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are some individuals here in Northwest Edmonton and St. Albert who were very active in the early days of Reform in terms of, President Manning's wife is from St. Albert. There's strong Reform roots right here where I represent. And, of course, those individuals who were early supporters of not only of Reform, but then the amalgamation between the Canadian Alliance and the Progressive Conservative Party, are very disappointed in the way the government has moved, not always, or not necessarily with policy direction, but in sort of the government's modus operandi. I mean, most commentators, most journalists who follow these things closely would comment frequently that this government is very closed. It's much more opaque than the promises of transparency that were promised in the 2006 Accountability Act. You have all sorts of secret decisions. You see a disrespect for Parliament constantly in omnibus budget bills. The one that was tabled two or three weeks ago, again, was just under 500 pages and had all sorts of things in it unrelated to the budget. And the purpose of an omnibus budget bill is so that matters can't be properly vetted or assessed, and they're all lumped together on one yes or no vote, as opposed to breaking it down into more digestible pieces and therefore debating unrelated pieces individually. And again, of course, the government's other main tactic in disrespecting Parliament is its almost a complete use of time allocation motions, limiting debate to a specified number of hours or specified numbers of days, and using its majority to force closure on issues to try to get its legislative agenda through the House with or without adequate debate or adequate vetting. And you see problems as a result of inadequate vetting, most notably the number of this government's law and order bills that have been struck down by the courts as being unconstitutional. I think if the government paid more respect to Parliament and more respect to and more deference to Parliament and Parliament committees' ability to properly vet legislation, ultimately more of it would be amended, but much less of it would be struck down by the courts, ultimately, you know, serving Canadians better.
I mean, we're blaming Stephen Harper, but I mean, prime ministers before him, I mean, going back to Pierre Trudeau, even before that perhaps, have been responsible for all of this, for the erosion of parliamentary democracy, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in my book Chronicles, I think it started in the late 60s under Prime Minister Pearson, who it was during that time that the Parliament amended its own standing orders to look for shortcuts in how it examined the government's spending plans, delegating it to the committees and then putting time limits on how much time could be spent examining the government's spending plans. And then in some famous changes to the Election Act in the early 1970s, party leaders were given essentially a veto over local decisions of local nomination committees, whereas the leader had to sign a candidate's nomination papers for that candidate to run under that party banner. So that allowed the party leader to veto any candidate that, for whatever reason, he or she didn't like. And then you just see, throughout the last 45 years since then, you just see a continual erosion of parliamentary supremacy and more and more power being vetted, first in cabinets and more recently in cabinet committees, and then ultimately where it rests now in the Prime Minister's office. But you're quite right. Although the current administration, the Harper administration, I think has taken centralized control to new and dangerous levels, they didn't invent it. And certainly they wouldn't have been able to concentrate power in the Prime Minister's office to the extent they had if their predecessors hadn't also taken steps to take power away from Parliament and put it in cabinet and then cabinet committee. So all of those steps through the 70s and 80s and 90s were conditioned precedents for the current attempts to concentrate power within the Prime Minister's office.
In the book, I guess, there are simple fixes that you suggest that could be taken up today and make the role of the MP more relevant, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's no magic bullet, there's no panacea, but there's a number of little things that I think we can try. Michael Chong, a colleague of mine, and a friend of mine from the Conservative Party, had a bill before Parliament, the Reform Act, which would take away what I just described was the leader of the party's ability to veto local nominations, mm-hmm. and it would create a sort of a structure for allowing a caucus to force a leadership review. And we saw sort of a strange situation in Manitoba unfold this week where five cabinet ministers resigned, but Premier Selinger is still carrying on. I don't know for how much longer. Chong's reform bill would have removed the leader's veto over the decisions of local riding associations and allowed a caucus to trigger a leadership review based on a petition of 20% of the members and then a majority vote by secret ballot. So these would have been brilliant changes to try to reverse the trend away from parliamentary supremacy by putting powers back in the caucuses and putting power back in the local riding associations as opposed to the leader's offices. But as we tend to see, all parties ended up supporting this bill, but on the understanding that there's going to be significant alterations at committee, which will veto, or which will render some of its more important provisions neutered. But there are other changes. I think electoral reform has some possibility. The first-past-the-post system that we employ leads to manufactured majority governments. We have a government which got about 39% of the vote in the last election, and that transferred to about 60% of the seats and 100% of the power. Electoral reform has some possibilities to try to even that out, form coalitions and minority parliaments. But ultimately, I think the key to restoring parliamentary supremacy is to limit the ability of leaders to promote backbenchers and therefore assure their absolute unequivocal support of those leaders. I think if cabinets were much smaller, if the role of parliamentary secretary was reduced or limited, if committee chairs were elected by all party committees as opposed to appointed by the leaders, if the party leader had less carrots to hand out, I think that would go a long way to restoring parliamentary supremacy. You see that in Great Britain, where Parliament is almost twice as big as our Canadian Parliament, and the Cabinet is almost half as small. So a British MP's chances mathematically of getting into Cabinet are very, very small, as low as about 1 in 30 in some instances, as opposed to about 1 in 2.5 here. And as a result, you see parliamentarians in Great Britain taking their role much more seriously, and you see that in things like a little over a year ago, there was a vote to commit British soldiers to the Syrian conflict, mm-hmm. and you probably remember that vote was defeated mm-hmm. when conservative backbenchers joined with their Labour colleagues to defeat the government's motion. Now, times have changed. We're now a year later, and both Canada and Britain are involved in the Middle East conflict. But my point is, this time last year, Britain, the British Parliament was not comfortable committing to the Syrian war, and even though it was a government motion, it was conservative backbenchers that helped Labour to defeat that motion. And to me, that was a good day for democracy. It wasn't a crisis. The government wasn't forced to resign. The pound didn't sink on in international money markets. All that occurred was that the British people spoke through their parliamentarians that they weren't comfortable with that military mission, and the motion was defeated. We'd be hard pressed to see the equivalent of that happening in Canada, where the leaders have so much control over their caucuses that it's really only their votes that matter, because their caucuses, with very few exceptions, vote lock, step and barrel with the party leaders. And, well, almost all parliamentary votes are, the outcome is known in advance once it's known how the leaders are going to vote. And I think if there were less carrots for leaders to mm-hmm. hand out, and if parliamentarians were resigned to the fact that they wouldn't be promoted, I think they would take their job of representing their constituents and representing taxpayers much more seriously. But that'll never happen until some of those other steps occur in the interim, like adopting some of Michael Chong's reforms, and perhaps tinkering with our electoral system so that leaders can't veto the nominations of local candidates.
Brent, I've got a couple more questions, if you don't mind. I know I've kept you longer than I said I would, but if you'll indulge me. Do you care to comment on the conduct of this speaker, the Speaker of the House, Mr. Scheer? Has he been a good advocate for the individual MP?
I think he's been a fair speaker, and I think actually tries his best to defend the rights of members of Parliament. In my book, I do question how the Speaker is chosen, mm-hmm. and it's not a criticism of Speaker Scheer generally, but it's just a criticism of how we choose our speakers generally. The Speaker is an elected member of Parliament, as you know, and is elected under a partisan banner, this one elected under the Conservative banner. And whether or not that creates a real bias is a matter for some dispute and some debate. But what is clear to, I think, everyone who studies it is that there's a clear apprehension of bias or possibility of bias. And for any system to work in an adversarial system, there has to be complete and total neutrality. And I'm a lawyer. In my previous life, I was a trial lawyer for a number of years. And the judicial system, of course, is premised on the fact that the judge is going to be neutral and unbiased. And when you employ that system, the way that we elect our speaker at the beginning of a parliamentary session, when you employ that to any other system, the sort of the illogical nature of it becomes readily apparent. I mean, could you imagine at the beginning of an NHL season, if the players all got elected, or all got together and elected some of the players from each team to be the head referee and the deputy referee? It seems crazy, but that's what we do. First of all, it takes away some of the best players because they no longer be able to play on their teams, and that's certainly the system that, or one of the downfalls of the current system, where that the speaker is no longer really in a position to advocate for his constituents because he can't and doesn't participate in debate. But secondly, there's always the apprehension of the potential for bias when a partisan is elected into that chair. And I'd like to see that changed. I would like to see an officer of parliament, a retired justice of a superior court, an officer of parliament similar to the chief electoral officer or the auditor general, somebody, a position of that type of prestige and neutrality and nonpartisan. I think that would make for a better system. And the speaker would be less likely, in my view, to enforce rules, including the suspension of members, than he is now, because his re-election of the next parliament is dependent in large extent on his popularity amongst the membership, because it's a free vote. And I think being popular is frequently inconsistent with being effective in a role either as judge, referee, or speaker.
And finally, Brent, my last question. You've been a member of Parliament now for 6 years, going into your seventh year into this election, into the next election cycle. Are you more cynical today than you were, say, in 2008?
Oh, absolutely. without any doubt. I mean, I think with most members of Parliament, I arrived, you know, with wide eyes and with expectations that I was going to have a great career and that I was going to change the world. And, you know, when I was very frustrated as a backbench member of the Conservative Caucus. I felt I had very little clout or influence even on the committees that I was sitting on. I sat on the Justice Committee for 5 years, or almost 4.5 years, and I was constantly being told how to vote even on proposed amendments at committee. Now, as an independent member of Parliament, I feel slightly more empowered, although I don't have the support of a caucus and would never get a private member's bill passed. Even when I was a member of the Conservative Caucus, I wasn't able to get my private member's bill passed. So yes, I feel very, very cynical and jaded that power is not in the elected Parliament, it's in the unelected staffers in the Prime Minister's office. And so every day I ask myself, you know, am I seriously going to run again? Do I seriously want to put myself through any more of this frustration? And I've decided that I'm going to, simply because I think that I have to continue to advocate on behalf of reforming democracy. And I want to dispel what is a commonly held myth, that if you quit a party or if you resign from a caucus, that your political career is over, that is somehow the equivalent of political suicide. I want to disprove that theory. I may or may not be successful, but if I successfully disprove that theory, I'm hoping that in the future members will be less hesitant to sever ties with their party, or at least they won't be scared to sever ties for their party simply because they think that that's going to be the termination of their political career. I want to prove that there is life after being a member of a caucus, and that's why I'm motivated to run in 2015.
Brent, this has been a great conversation. This is a great read, an engaging book. Continued good luck with it and your work. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you and your listeners for your interest.
The website for more, brentrethgaber.ca. The book is called Irresponsible Government, The Decline of Parliamentary Democracy in Canada. It's published by Dundurn. Brent Rathgaber, MP, joined me on the line from Edmonton in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.